Hello, fellow foodies, and welcome back. This is Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you're listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious. This week on the show, we're going to dive into the topic of barons. We're going to be talking about the industrial food system, and I have just the guests to help us along in developing a better understanding of how the system has come to be what it is today. Our guest today is Austin Frerich. He's an expert on agricultural and antitrust policy. He worked at the Open Markets Institute, the U.S. Department of Treasury, and the Congressional Research Service before becoming a fellow at Yale University. He's a seventh-generation Iowan and a first-generation college graduate with degrees from Grinnell College and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Austin is author of a new book entitled Barons: Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Austin. It's great to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Doctor.
Yeah. So let's start with a little bit about your book. So Barons is the story of seven different modern day corporate barons who dominate the food industry. How did you choose these seven? And were there any that you didn't include?
Yeah, so it's kind of weird. Each baron is really more about a structure. So I first kind of figured out what structures do I want to talk about in the food system. And then I found a baron to kind of wrap around it. Mm-hmm. So like, I really want to talk about the farm bill, like what's happened to the American farm bill over the last, you know, century. And then I would find like what baron story would fit best here. And, you know, when you put together a book proposal, you have a certain idea of what you're going to do, but things naturally change as you research. Like my farm bill baron was originally going to be Driscoll's. I really wanted to talk about that, but then as I did my research, I stumbled upon Cargill. And I grew up around Cargill, but I never really realized their power. I mean, they are the largest private company in America. They are bigger than Coke Industry. And then, I mean, I kind of joked to my husband, there's a whole B-side barons where, sure, these people have a lot of power. They can shape industries. But, you know, they didn't really fit with the different points I was trying to make from a structural standpoint.
Cool. So maybe we should back up a second and tell us a little bit more about the farm bill so we can really dive into how these barons, I mean, I can imagine the influence that Cargill has on the farm bill and legislature. So maybe tell us a little bit more about what the farm bill actually is and what does it regulate or what laws is it in place? Yeah.
I mean, I made decisions when I was doing this research to really distill the farm bill because, you know, farm bill happens every 5 or so years. And I really focus on two, like the original farm bill, what I call the New Deal farm bill, which is actually a collection of bills. And then what I call the 1996 one, the Wall Street farm bill. And I kind of set these up as dichotomies where the original farm bill was really designed to manage, like to find equilibrium. Because what we saw with the Dust Bowl was farmers were pushing on their land, they're overproducing. And then the markets were glutted. Well, when you're barely keeping onto your farm, you're going to keep producing more and more just so you can make a little bit. So that whole farm bill, it created crop insurance, conservation programs, subsidies, but they were interlocked. So if you got conservation money, you were supposed to, then you had to, you know, you had to do conservation practices in order to get it, to get, you know, the subsidy. Fast forward, what we slowly saw over time was that deregulation where those kind of that interlocking nature was removed and the farm bill shifted to being designed to overproduce grains. Overproduce a few things. So if you go grow carrots right now, you get nothing, essentially. And so like, I always joke, the only farmer that really operates in the free market is like a farmer's market farmer. whereas like, you know, if you grow corn in the Midwest, you're getting subsidized up the wazoo for all these different ways. And for my grain baron Cargill, that's what they want. I mean, they're the middleman. I really compare them to Standard Oil where most Americans never heard of them. They're not brand facing, consumer facing, but they own the rails. They own the middle. They move like, I think a third or a fourth of the grain in the whole globe.
Wow.
They process it. They do all that. And they just want to produce more and more grain. That's their business model. So they were part of that process of deregulating the farm bill and allowing the consolidation of power and overproduction of a few things.
Well, what's incredible to me too is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I've always understood that the corn that they're producing under the majority of corn being produced under the subsidies of the farm bill aren't actually for direct human consumption, right? Is a lot of this going to animal feed? Like, is this really a meat bill and not a vegetable bill, I guess?
It's like burn in your car / meat bill. I mean, it is, nothing gets me more irked when I hear them say feed the world. Because it's like, if you wanted to feed the world, you wouldn't burn the corn in your cars. That's like the amount of delusional in this space is incredible because there's so much corporate money sloshing around where people, you know, it means so much. The animals used to eat, you know, forage on themselves, feed themselves, you know, dairy cows on pasture. Now we're using fossil fuels to produce the feed. Could we put them inside metal sheds? You know, this whole model is just so destructive. Honestly, so many of your guests have pointed out.
Yeah. No, I'm thinking in particular of, we had a guest a few years ago, Maren McKenna, who wrote this book called Big Chicken about how antibiotics got into our agricultural system, which was just mind blowing for me. And what shocks me too is like, there's always this nuance around how things are portrayed. I didn't know, for example, that chickens can still be labeled as antibiotic free and yet still receive antibiotics when they're in the egg. So they'll inject them with antibiotics before they hatch. And that's considered an antibiotic free chicken, which, you know, any person could say, actually, well, if they're getting the antibiotic, whether they're in the egg or out of the egg, it's still they're getting the antibiotic. So I get this feeling, like you're saying, there is this marketing blitz around how these products feed the world, how it's being portrayed to the American public that isn't really reflective of the actual reality of what they're doing with these crops.
It's delusional. I mean, it is the second half of that chapter really is, what are the impacts of this Wall Street Farm Bill?
Yeah.
When the Farm Bill is designed for Pepsi to make pops as cheap as, to make pops and chip as cheap as possible, this is the system we have, mm-hmm. where basically it takes money to be healthy in America now. Yeah. Because a whole system, my last baron is Walmart, then my grocery baron, which honestly shocks most people that Walmart really is a grocery store at the end of the day. And Walmart, they want one company to do all 4,000 stores and they want that supply chain, and that's not conducive to carrots. Mm. Or, you know what I mean? Carrots from different production regions.
Yeah. So walk me through these seven barons. So you have a baron for kind of the corn production. You've got the baron for grocery stores. What are some of the other examples that you get into?
So my first baron out the gate is my hog baron. Oh. This chapter is really, yeah. This is the one that got me the book deal. This hog baron is what started it all. I was in a bar in Des Moines. I was just kind of BSing with someone, one of those classic dive bars, you know. And they were telling me how the largest political donor in the state, and this is 2018, Iowa had a very contentious governor's race, was a hog baron. This one person wrote a $300,000 check to the governor because we don't have campaign limits in Iowa. And what this person was telling me is this hog baron has a private jet at the Des Moines airport, and rumored is on the jet he has when pigs fly. And I just thought that was great copy. That's like, awesome. What is this story? Yeah, and like I started digging, and that led to a magazine article in Vox, which then led to this book. Because I just love, my brain thinks structurally. Mm-hmm. You know, I am trained to give you a thesis of evidence, but people need a story. They need that emotion. And what I love about the Baron framework is it's both, it's almost cartoonish. It's funny. It's interesting. But also for people, I'm hearkening back to the previous Robert Barons and something where we've dealt with this issue before. Like, we know what to do here. So that's how this all kind of came together. So my hog barons really is about what happened to Iowa, like the corporate capture of my home state. And then from there, I basically ordered the barons, like I'm building on concepts. So like I go to the grain baron because I want to teach you what the farm bill is. And then from there, I go to coffee baron, which is the secret German family called JAB. They sell more coffee than Starbucks. They weren't even in America until 2012. They own Keurig. They own Stumptown. They own Pret a Manger, Panera, Intelligentsia, Krispy Kreme, Sonia cookies, like... massive amount. Like it is, they basically rolled up coffee.
Incredible.
That's incredible. I love, that's one of my favorite little cocktail pieces of trivia from the book is the coffee baron. But I mean, I use their story to tell this bigger story of monopoly because they have a really dark history of, they have a dark Nazi past to them, an underappreciated history to post-World War II reconstruction by America and Japan and Europe was antitrust enforcement, where we realized monopolist finance fascist. So you can see the parallels I'm pulling
out. Yep.
So those cars don't need this anymore. From there, I go to my dairy baron, which I use to talk about. They own this branded milk called Fairlife. You might have seen it in the grocery store. Coke just bought it from them. I use their story to tell this bigger story, this hidden, secret, powerful thing at USDA called checkoffs. It's these little things like got milk comes out of it. That's a conversation for later, but it really... it's part of, to me, the corporate capture of the academic literature in the agriculture space really comes from that. From there, I go to Driscoll's is my berry baron. Driscoll's grows 1 in 3 berries in America, but they don't grow a single berry. They sell 1 in 3 berries, but they don't grow a single berry. They took that chicken model production and applied it to berries. So they own the IP of the berry, but they contract out the growing. So that way you can shift berry production offshore, squeeze labor, and pretend you didn't know.
Wow. There's a lot of kind of socioeconomic concerns around food production as a result of these monopolies. I'm thinking, well, just again, going back to chickens is, you know, people become indebted running these chicken houses. And it used to be that you could make a living as a family farmer, but now the model is set such that you become so in debt to these parent companies, you have no ownership really over your own farm. So this is also happening with produce basically abroad. Tell me more. So we've got berry barons, we have hog, we have grocery, grain. Where else are these monopolies affecting our food systems?
Real quick though, I want to just add on to that chicken point, because there's been a lot of great writing on chicken, but what you realize is, first of all, that chicken model goes back to slavery. I mean, it's known as the Southern model. An academic coined that phrase in like 2008, where you're shifting all the risk to the, it's a whole power dynamic thing. I mean, that's yeah. really what sharecropping was. It's modern day sharecropping. It's really what it is, but it's so profitable. If you can shift all the burden to someone else and squeeze them as that much, you see why, where it started off in chicken. And the whole history of chicken is fascinating, because when a lot of these meat laws were written a century ago, after Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, all mm-hmm. that popular revolt, Americans didn't eat a lot of chicken. So a lot of the regulations wasn't written for chicken. So chicken was able to essentially go under this regulatory structure, vertically integrate into the sharecropping model, which it's not surprising that chicken comes out of the South, because it took that model of production, formerly applied to black farmers, applied it to the chicken. Instead of USDA saying, no chicken, you behave like every other protein, it became a race to the bottom, where then the hog industry copied it. Now we're seeing berry copied it, where you're just kind of seeing this race to the bottom because of just this self. It's incredibly profitable. It's incredibly destructive, profitable model. And that's kind of where, from there, I go on to My Slaughtering Baron, which kind of talks about a lot of this meat production. I really focus that chapter on the kind of the corruption of USDA, but also like what this means for workers. And then I close off the book with Walmart as my grocery baron. I really think Walmart is like the queen baron, like the king of kings. Their market power, they're the richest family in the world's ever seen.
Wow. Well, and I know that when they do go one direction, like for example, you know, even, I don't know when it really became popularized, it had to have been less than 20 years ago when Walmart made the shift towards including organic products and their lineup, that actually shifted the production of foods, you know, on a global scale, I'm guessing, because they're such a big supplier of groceries. So what they decide to go with can really shape markets. That's an incredibly powerful tool.
100%. I mean, it's supply and command. I mean, I first do the research on these chapters, read thousands of articles to get my head around it, made a mm-hmm. massive note document. Started kind of organizing my thoughts. And then I got to start figuring out, okay, what's the narrative of this chapter? So I asked some grocery people I know, former grocery executives, and they're like, Austin, like, this is a risk management strategy. Walmart knows it's such a vulture to its suppliers. It puts its supply chain at risk if they're too dependent on them.
Oh.
Because for most, anyone writes a book, my spouse and I would argue a lot. I just kind of work out loud, you know, over dinner. I really originally wanted to frame this chapter around Walmart's the closest thing we've ever had in America to a Politburo. They really command our economy. I mean, their market share in grocery, they sell 1 in 3 groceries domestically, which is the same as a second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh combined.
Wow.
It is wild. Like one little example of just our market power is I love reading Trade Press. I found these little niche publications that have the best stuff for research. And that northwest corner of Arkansas, that's the center of like the import business in America. Like they call it Walmart's headquartered in Bentonville, but they jokingly called it Venderville. And Walmart, there's a whole news outlet that covers that ecosystem. And Walmart has this rule I discovered where if you're a supplier to Walmart, you can't sell them more than 30% of your goods to Walmart. Which I honestly, same thing. I was like, wait, what is that? I don't quite understand this. Yeah, for most of them, they basically Walmart's a wash. Either they lose money at Walmart or whatever, but they need to make their money elsewhere to be profitable.
Interesting.
Which is just like, that's fascinating power.
Yeah. It's definitely, I'm seeing this trend of really stacking the odds in the favor of the corporate power, whereas growers are assuming risk. And this is kind of in contrast to what I think is communicated going back to the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill is pitched by so many politicians as the safety net for our farmers. And there's this kind of white picket fence model of agriculture that's portrayed. And we have to do this to protect our farmers. But are we protecting our farmers? I mean, are we really? Are we just protecting like Wall Street?
Yeah, Dr. Quave, I think it's Wall Street. I mean, they're using the facade, that illusion. By every metric, we failed. I mean, like you look at meat and dairy production, the family farm has basically essentially died. Mm-hmm. I mean, an undercurrent of this book too is Secretary Vilsack. To me, he oversaw the death of the family hog farm as governor of Iowa, then oversaw the death of the dairy family farm, the Secretary of Agriculture. And it's a classic political move where you see people, I mean, because they're not competing on a fair playing field.
Yeah.
I mean, as a lot of people pointed out, when you're using an undocumented worker, you're screwing them, you're cutting corners in the environment, you're doing all these incredibly destructive practices, you're going to have a cost advantage in the marketplace. And so people are screaming out for help. Help us. It's not fair. We are producing, we're losing money. And people like Vilsack are like, oh, we'll study it, whatever. They're buying time. And basically the dirty secret with a lot of these barons is they have access to Wall Street capital. And they're just going to win. They're going to outlast you.
Yeah, I can imagine. Like he who has the most money to keep the lawyers' pockets full wins the race, right? They're the ones that are going to come out ahead or can invest heavier. I mean, I guess what I've seen through all the conversations I've had with different experts across the domains of food and health is that this has come at a cost to our health. It comes at a cost to our health of our ecosystems, but also to us as humans. What did you learn in your research on those domains? I mean, are there any big findings you had on that side of things?
Yeah, I actually found that to be one more harder things to talk about, to be honest with you. I really took to heart the work of Dr. Julie Guthman at University of Santa Cruz. California, Santa Cruz, where so much of this conversation over health and obesity has been centered on the individual.
Personal blame. Personal response. It's all your fault. Personal. You just don't have the willpower. You make bad choices. You're so lazy. Yes. This is the narrative.
This is a fantastic book called Weighing In, where it's all structural. And I think it's, I don't know. The thing I'm really mystified by, the two big things in my head right now is we've never had in the history of mankind the lower income classes be the overweight class. Mm-hmm. Usually that was reverse. Usually it was the rich class that was dealing with. But then at the same time, there's a whole Ozempic thing I find scary and fascinating on so many levels, because to me, I think it'll just be another marker of class. I mean, I just remember seeing this news story in the Wall Street Journal where the highest use of Ozempic is in the Upper East Side of New York, where it's just like, it's such a marker of class in America, an unsaid thing. I found that subject area really I spent a lot of time on that. I mean, I worked on this book for 5 years, ran this draft. You know how it is when you write, you run it by friends and you just kind of, cause it's such a, that conversation is such a loaded conversation for people. And you don't, how do you have a conversation over of like, cause I think to me, what I really internalize is everything we eat is subsidized. The question is to the degree of what. I love when we travel, I love going to grocery stores, and you just see it in grocery stores. Like, Dollar General's food assortment is going to be very different than Whole Foods.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's all about access to foods. And even, I don't know, I travel a lot in my job. And I can tell you that in the time that I spend away, now granted, I'm probably walking more because I'm out on the road. I'm moving around a lot more. But I'm also, the food I eat in other countries doesn't leave me feeling lethargic and just tired, stuffed in the way that the American diet does. I think, you know, there's a bigger emphasis on more whole integrated foods and less, you know, super processed foods. I mean, I think part of the problem with the lower economic classes in America is the only foods we have accessible to this cohort are the extremely processed foods that are only made possible to be that cheap, right? Because of these heavy subsidies. And it becomes such a systemic issue. I get a bit hopeless about it. Like, how can we fix this? Is there a path forward for making changes in the farm bill? Like, what did you learn about that? I mean, or is it going to take another Upton Sinclair moment to revolutionize our food system?
It's almost an irony of writing this book where, like, during this process, like, I developed gluten sensitivity, which is funny because, like, my husband jokes, Iowa food is like 50 shades of beige with tons of carbs.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's a lot of new science out there. I mean, I didn't touch this because this was just not my background, but a lot of the trauma animals feel in these industrial production models, we're taking that on when we eat their byproducts, mm-hmm. or we eat them. Keep in mind, too, a lot of these antibiotics are used for weight gainers.
Yeah, absolutely, to put on weight, and then puts us at risk, of course, for even more antibiotic-resistant infections to be spread. Yeah.
But the two things, like, I think an underappreciated thing about this whole neoliberal consolidation of power is the collapse of taste. And you see a little examples of it, strawberries. Mm-hmm. You buy, those berries are engineered for transportation. They're not engineered for taste. So anyone that's like, if you're growing strawberries in your backyard, they're just so much better.
Yes.
And even like bacon, like you're in the day, you're eating the muscle of an animal. Industrial bacon and the old fashioned bacon, it's just night and day different. Like a piggy that runs around, does piggy things, his muscles are just going to taste better than mm-hmm. a pig that stands all day and eats corn.
Yeah.
I do. So that is like a lost thing of this. Like that's when most Americans go abroad, they try food elsewhere. Like it's so much better. And that's because this model doesn't reward taste. It Walmart doesn't care about that. It just cares about selling product.
It's about scales of economy. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that's the most disappointing thing. You have these beautiful, bright red strawberries. It looks so perfect, but it's really a trick because they taste so flavorless. It's and if that's all you're accustomed to, you don't know that there's something else out there. I think we've also lost an eye for diversity. I mean, I think about if we could only go back one century, just one century, and have an opportunity to look at some of the different varieties of apples that were so commonplace across the country, even 100 years ago. And, you know, we've lost those, or we're losing them, both in small farms and growing in the wild, and certainly they're not present in cultivation. Yeah.
Writing this book is like, but I want to get back to where we go from here because that is... Yeah,
we need hope. Give us some hope. Like, how do we move forward? How do we fix some of this, at least... start to fix it.
But Dr. Quave, like that's the thing I struggled with a lot is I felt like a lot of books too in this space give you false hope. Mm-hmm. And I think I also wrote this book as, I mean, I come from Iowa. I'm a first generation college student. Most of my family are Trumpers. Like I just have a certain, it's a weird mix of optimism and cynicism of like, I saw it all fall apart. I saw cows and hogs in the land when I was little and now it's gone. My hope is like, and so I didn't want to write that book of like, well, we're turning the corner. You know what I mean? Just that kind of.
Yeah.
Because so much of that is like part of that problem is a lot of those that world's coming out. I call it the Brooklyn Brownstone kind of world. But my hope is kind of three things come to mind. One, we're going to have a reckoning with ethanol. To me, the silver lining of what everything about Elon Musk, he is driving the transition to EVs that's going to kill ethanol. And my biggest hope is we take that land that was formerly in corn production and put animals back on the land. Because most of the corn crop now is being used for ethanol production. And what are we going to do if we don't need that anymore? I mean, industry's starting to freak out. You're starting to see them say, oh, let's put ethanol on airplanes. That's their new thing.
Wow. So this is just for clarity too, for the audience, you're talking about the production of fuel from corn byproducts. So we're using massive amounts of land, arable lands to grow things that are going into our vehicles. And I've also heard this is not really, I think it's been pitched as a sustainable alternative to fossil fuels, but it's actually really not sustainable at all. It's like, you know, it's easy. Oh, it's green. It's coming from a plant, but no, this is actually not good for the environment.
I purposely made that conversation really short in my book, like three sentences. This conversation's over. Scientists are not on the payroll of corn. Say it's basically a wash at best. The Museum of Failure even put it in as an exhibit item. Like, because they, you know what I mean? There's going to be so many agriculture economists who are going to argue about this. And it's just like, well, tell me, disclose your funding. And then we'll have an honest conversation.
I think that's also tricky. Like, I mean, well, I know like in the space of pharmaceutical or pharmacological research, you are required to disclose any conflicts of interest on your research papers. And it's curious to me how in like a lot of ag, that doesn't always happen, that they're not disclosing, well, I'm actually a scientist that got paid this big bonus from this baron or that baron to write this, you know, perspective paper saying that this amazing thing they're doing is just the way to go and has no risk or downsides. I mean, that's wild, but that's not better enforced or required.
Well, I'm smiling so much. I stepped back for a few last few years. I've been deputy director of an antitrust center at Yale. And I stepped back to kind of focus on this book. But what I love about working with students is a lot of them, we're working with a lot of law students. Mm-hmm. And quite a few of them were consultants, worked in industry before coming to law school. And what was so cool is a lot of them care about food, but you know, they grew up in the suburbs. They don't really know it, but they would see concepts elsewhere and apply it. And IP, a lot of them worked in pharmaceutical. And they're like, wait, all these shenanigans that's not allowed here is occurring here?
Yeah, and that happened.
How did that happen? Like, there was a fantastic young lawyer wrote a paper, Kate Conlow, how she was a former journalist turned lawyer, and all these agriculture economic journals have disclosure policies. They're not enforced. Mm-hmm. And if you go with their court records where they disclose their funding, or even their personal websites where they brag about how much money they get, you see it. And there's such a mismatch of, in this public square, you have all these academics with fancy sounding titles. And anyone that's been on a land grant knows power comes through how much money you're bringing in. And so a lot of these undergrads, let's be frank, they really don't care. They want their students to get jobs at these companies. As long as you go through the veneer of legitimacy, that's all they care about. And so that to me is like the biggest thing you're going on with the land grant is the privatization of them, the warping of this conversation, and the inability to really have an honest conversation because of all this money sloshing around. Mm-hmm. But so I talk about ethanol, but like to me, speaking of academics, they give me hope. I think the appointment of Lina Khan of the chairwoman as the Federal Trade Commission is so huge. And I think is such a good example for the food space. Here's a young academic who wrote an academic paper that went viral.
Cool.
Have you heard about this?
I have not. You know, share, tell us what it's about.
When she was a young law, so she was, she was a journalist. She wrote about chicken monopolies, how the Obama administration failed to do anything about meat monopolies. Mm-hmm. That's how I first met her. I found that paper to me explained a lot of what I was thinking at the time. In 2016, she wrote a law article at the Yale Law Journal about Amazon's monopoly. And when the New York Times even did a piece on it, because it was becoming such a little, in that little world, that space that's calcified, going back to the Reagan, where Reagan's failed Supreme Court nominee, Robert Bork, really set the conversation over this. Basically, monopoly is good. he dressed it up in fancier ways. But she wrote this paper really challenging that orthodoxy. And I mean, you have a young woman of color saying we need to look at power holistically. You can't do it on an Excel sheet. And of course, a bunch of older men lost it. Biden appointed her, though, to the Federal Trade Commission, which can bring the monopoly lawsuits.
Nice.
And she's bringing the lawsuits. I mean, she is bringing lawsuits against Google, Apple, Amazon. I don't think the Apple one's been filed yet, Amazon, all this. And what you're seeing in this discourse space is the academic discourse has changed completely in the antitrust world. She ushered in a new post-neoliberalism framework where a lot of the young, I mean, she's an inspiring figure, young mother. I think she's maybe 32, 33.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like she is, it's incredible. And like what I say about that, and I think the food space needs to think about is you're never going to teach someone like Vilsack to do the right thing.
Yeah.
They'll tell you what you want to hear, but they'll never do it. Imagine things will change when the positions of power change. Mm-hmm. So imagine pushing for the appointment. I always joke to people, there's one of the people I look up to is this corn scientist named Ricardo Salvador. He helped run the Union of Concerned Scientists. Imagine if he was Secretary of Agriculture.
Yeah. I mean, we have a climate reckoning on our hands as well. We have a soil reckoning. I mean, we've depleted our topsoils. We're facing really, I mean, very real challenges. And the foods that we are growing right now are not, you know, they're very much geared towards this, you know, ultra processed diet. When it comes to the people in power, who are the people in power that, for example, have the power to write and get the farm bill approved? Like, who is that? And is there a way for listeners or concerned citizens that are, you know, interested in the farm bill, is there a way for them to advocate? Because I think we're also against some very real hurdles of the advocacy coming out of these monopolies. They're going to be throwing all the money and legal prowess they have at getting whatever's most favorable to their particular company's needs. So how do we push back on that to fight for a more just food system and a healthier food system as just a citizen?
So, yeah, I'm going to kind of, like, this sounds weird, like a high and low level kind of approach where at a high level, I am two things. One, I actually think we should have a conversation about stripping USDA for parts. I think by every metric, USDA has failed. For every dollar you spend at the grocery store, farmers get the least amount possible. The way the workers are treated, the food we eat. FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, oversees most monopoly stuff in America except for meat production. Mm. USDA does it. Take that away from them. Take SNAP, take food assistance, put it under HHS. Like, we need to have these conversations because it's like,
so honestly, restructuring is, basically is what you're proposing. Restructure. Okay.
Yeah. Because so much of these structures go back to the Civil War.
Yeah.
And that is just not this country. That is not where science is at. That is not, that's one high level. The other high level thought, I actually think the Farm Bill is too corrupt at this point.
Yeah.
I would, and I should also say when I talk Farm Bill, I'm talking about that 25%.
Yeah. Just light it on fire. It's like, let's start over.
But that's like, there's weirdly a coalition forming on that. I think we should junk it. Let's put food assistance to the side. I'm talking about the crop insurance, all that.
Yeah.
Take that money and just put it in conservation. Like, it's, the Farm Bill shouldn't pick winners. It's picking winners and losers. Let's not play that game. And I think you're actually seeing a coalition form where you have, I mean, the Republican Party can't, I mean, the Farm Bill can't, it's, they can't even pass a continuation of an old one right now because it's getting too expensive, this much subsidy.
Yeah.
I think Heritage libertarian type are ready to gut it because, like, I think crop insurance, it's like 60 some percent subsidized by the taxpayer.
Wow. And again, it's not, just to be clear, when we're talking about crop insurance, this is not necessarily de-risking things for your small town farmer. This is for de-risking and putting all the balls into the court of these large monopolies that are managing these systems. I mean, I would love to see more support for local farmers for production of healthy vegetables to make them more accessible. It's insane to me how expensive vegetables have become to just be able to access fresh produce. I'd love to also see more investment in community gardens to help, you know, I recognize in tight urban centers, we don't necessarily have the land mass to grow all of your food locally. People don't know how to grow food any longer. And they really, in many cases, we've also been almost, I don't know if you agree with this, but I get the sense that we've kind of lost that knowledge of how to even prepare food from scratch. I teach highly educated college students and they can understand the theories behind what we're talking about. They can understand the chemistry, the active molecules and the pathways upon which they act in our body. But if I ask them, can you prepare this dish? They don't know where to start. Like, this is something we've lost in our cultural heritage is how to grow. And even if you're not growing the food, how to prepare a meal from scratch. Everything's out of a box.
And that's why, I mean, that's what, to me, this is where you can personally do stuff. One is get these, like, change, like, get your schools, your local colleges to make these local buys. First of all, it's good politically. Like, who doesn't want your food served to your kids coming from pasture dairy, pasture, local carrot farmers, what have you. Any farmer will tell you they will take institutional contracts any day because farmer's market, I mean, it's a gamble. You might get rained out. You have to put on a little performance. As I had a farmer joke to me, she has to put on her little drag outfit, like put on a little like sun skirt because you're selling an image to yuppies.
Yeah.
Whereas like, if you could just know every day I'm sending to this university or every week, that makes your life so much easier. And it also just stabilizes those farmers trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
That's huge. And people are doing that. Like, that is the beauty. That's like an undercurrent. I really, like, to me, I realized with this book is there are a lot of people we know what the solutions are here and there are a lot of people working for it. It's just a few greedy, mostly men holding us back.
Yeah.
And then the other thing too, like, just your point of, I love the idea of edible schoolyard. That's Alice Waters' idea. And that's just an updated version of home economics. Like, and I've been fortunate to spend time with her. Like, we sat on a class together and you realize for a lot of students, like, it's a way to, they need that experimental learning. I mean, Alice has a Montessori education background. Mm-hmm. And so it's like kids can read about the Silk Road or what have you, or, you know, second graders learning about math, and then they can apply those concepts doing that over food.
Yeah.
Making a meal. And it's just like simple things of like, you're right. I mean, I'm embarrassed. I just learned a few years ago how to get a chicken and like take it apart.
Yeah. I mean, that's a fantastic example. It is so much cheaper to buy a whole chicken, even a whole organic chicken, than to get all the cut up parts of it. I'm like, why? Yeah. Why are we afraid to handle our food? It's, yeah.
The one my mom makes fun of me all the time is my husband got a free turkey from work last year. Mm-hmm. And I cooked it upside down. Like, she still has that photo. I was so proud. Like, Mom, look, I cooked my first turkey. Yeah, and she's like, it's upside down. But it's just, to me, what I realized, especially in the last year, is you got to offer people hope.
Yes.
You can't just be broken, which I wrote a book on robber barons. Trust me. Mm-hmm. People crave a positive vision. And like that to me is my hope here is in the history of America, it's usually we run a model into the ground before we do the right thing. And like my hope in my little sandbox is like, I hope Iowa could be the Italy of one day, or like the Italy of America, because it has the best soil. These little towns are really cute. People want, I don't know. I mean, I notice on Netflix every week there seems to be like a food thing in the top 10. People want to, they want something better.
Yeah. No, I agree. Fantastic. Well, Austin, I've loved learning more about your book. I know it's coming out this spring. Your release date is going to be, it's March 26th. March 26th. It'll be out. Again, foodies, the title is Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. I highly recommend this. A great read. Austin, where else can we send them to find information about you and about your book?
Yeah. So on all my social medias, my handle is Austin Frerick, F-R-E-R-I-C-K. My website's austinfrerick.com or IOAF. And to the foodies out there, my two little things are, one, I love hearing what barons people find the most interesting. And then also, like, honestly, let me know if I missed something or just kind of little nuggets. Like, to me, those actually, when I first published that Ogburn article, it was people reaching out afterwards where you just realize, you know, it makes for a richer story. There's new layers you learn. It's the lived experiences are just so much richer. And so like, I love hearing that. Like, that's one of my favorite little things are when people kind of, hey, you should look over here or that kind of stuff.
Awesome. Awesome. So that's great. So they can reach you through your website and through your social. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Austin, for coming to the show. It's great having you.
Yeah. Thank you so much too.
Yeah. You've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious, brought to you today on Squadcast. You can find this and all of our other shows at foodiepharmacology.com. We also have some fun swag for you on the site. You can get some fun totes or coffee mug. I'm also very hungry for some coffee. So if you guys don't mind buying me a coffee, that's a great, simple way you can help support the show. I want to give a shout out of thanks to our producers, to Rob Cohen and Christine Roth, for putting on a great show for you each week. And thank you to you, our listeners, for sticking with us. We're now again in season 6 of Foodie Pharmacology, over 190,000 downloads and growing. So continue listening. It's great to have you here. Have a great week.